Well, welcome back to HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate. And this is Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate, here with Dr. Gregory Eastwood from Upstate Center for Bioethics and Humanities and Dr. Thomas Dennison from Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Public Policy, discussing the ethics of healthcare reform. And Dr. Dennison, during the break, you clarified something for me that I had not understood about the system in Great Britain. Will you explain to our listeners what we were talking about?
Well, there are very few examples around the world of systems of care that are entirely socialized in the sense that they are both financed and provided by the government. There are mixed models. We find a large number of systems that are financed by the government, but the delivery of care is often a mix of private and public. In Great Britain, the hospital system, by and large, is owned by the government. There are private hospitals in Great Britain as well.
And, of course, they're the payer.
The government is the payer for those things that are covered by the National Health Service.
Uh-huh.
For those things that are not covered by the National Health Service, you can purchase privately from the private sector, private hospitals. There are private hospitals that do plastic surgery and elective procedures that may not be covered under the National Health Plan. Physicians, by and large, are in private practice. They contract with the government for a percentage of their time, up to 100% of their time, and provide services covered under the National Health Plan. But if they contract for 80%, they can see private patients who can see those physicians and get and earn money on a private side.
You know, what is so fascinating to me is that I hear Americans, and I hear from them, I get email from them, and people who comment on my blog, all up in arms. We do not want a socialist system. We do not what they want and have. We do not want what they have in Great Britain or in Canada. And yet, every time you describe it, it sounds to me exactly like the kinds of things people are asking for. Dr. Eastwood, that was your point, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, and in this country, as we said last segment, that military medicine, a huge system. By the way, it's military medicine that many people in Congress and the President of the United States use. They go to Bethesda Naval Hospital or, you know, other hospitals like that.
And, you know, that's something else. People say, boy, all I want is the system that they've got, that the senators have and the congressmen have. That's
right.
The system I want. And the system they want is exactly what we're talking about, which is, in effect, socialized medicine.
It's certainly a socialized medicine, and it's good medical care. And the real issue is, do we want that applied throughout the whole country? That's the real issue.
That really is the issue. All right, let's talk about some current events for a moment. As of this week, we now have 5 plans that have been proposed, 3 that have been proposed by the Senate, 2 that have been proposed by the House of Representatives. And now it's going to be up to different groups to take those plans and try to move something forward. Dr. Dennison, what can you tell us about those plans? There are some tenets in there that people say they're for, but may really be against and not understand it. What are some of the things we need to know about these plans?
Well, what is clear when you look at the plans individually and then as a collective pile, it's evident that we are reluctant to change the status quo in the context of the delivery of healthcare.
And when you say we, and I'm sorry to be picky about this, but we isn't necessarily we, the American people, in my point of view.
The Congress.
And the Congress doesn't necessarily always represent, even though they're supposed to.
Well, that's the theory of our government.
It is.
They are elected by the people and they represent the people. Now, their views are heavily influenced by the special interest groups.
Yes.
And it's clear that the special interest groups are very much alive and well and trying to shape the way this policy is developed.
Yes. And according to, it was either Forbes or Business Week, $1.4 million per day is being spent by the insurance lobby to influence what's going on in Congress.
Well, the insurance lobby has the most to lose.
Follow the money.
In the context of changing the way they do business in their life. So they are actively trying to squelch anything and using scare tactics and using misinformation.
One of the reports that came out this week was the insurance, I think it's AHIPS program. Mm-hmm. They came out with a report from PricewaterhouseCoopers with all the number crunching and what a horror it was going to be if, in fact, health reform passes. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, as a former director in PricewaterhouseCoopers healthcare practice, I'm embarrassed that PwC would narrow the scope of an analysis to such an extent that the findings can be used in a misleading way. PricewaterhouseCoopers only analyzed certain segments of the legislation, knowing that the client, the insurance industry, would use this in lobbying. they came out right after the insurance industry used it in lobbying and said, wait a minute, we only analyzed a portion of the bill, so you can't necessarily use these conclusions in a sweeping fashion.
So were they backpedaling in effect?
They're very good at qualifying things.
Ah, okay. All right, so these are the numbers, but these numbers
were
produced.
Only asked to analyze these elements. We did. This is what the findings are.
So you're suggesting we should take that with a grain of salt?
Well, Jonathan Gruber, who is very well known, was actually here in Syracuse giving a talk at the Maxwell School a week or so ago, did an analysis that basically said that not only did PwC not look at all the elements, they didn't interpret the data correctly.
Oh, there you go. Now, but there are some big picture things in these five bills. Let's talk about things like pre-existing conditions and public options and health insurance exchanges. Any, all, some included in these five options?
Changes in underwriting rules, pre-existing conditions, guaranteed issue, those are pretty much across the board in the bills. And those are very good things.
Mm-hmm.
If we get nothing other than some of those insurance changes, we will have made progress.
But they'll cost us a fortune.
They will cost money, unless we have a corresponding set of activities that will bring costs down. And that's where we're quite lacking.
Mm-hmm.
We don't seem to see anything that will change the fundamental fee-for-service sovereignty of the physician model of care. We don't see enough discussion about the reality that we are overcompensating specialists and undercompensating primary care physicians and others who don't do procedures. If we don't move away from fee-for-service and procedure-based reimbursement and payment, we won't bring costs down. We can't afford to increase coverage without the corresponding cost reductions.
My grandfather used to say, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. And it strikes me that a lot of what we're hearing about healthcare reform is really just that.
Well, if we don't address our continued embrace of new technology in an unfettered way,
mm-hmm.
if we don't deal with the incentives inherent in fee-for-service medicine, that the more I do, the more money I get, and that runs through mm-hmm. physician care and hospital care, then we will not slow down the cost of health care.
Dr. Eastwood, yeah. How does all this tie into ethics?
Well, let me just comment on this. You know, I think sometimes people who advocate great change for something, anything, in this case health care, are disappointed when they don't get the whole enchilada.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in our political system, it's very unusual to make great change. I can think of one great change, and it occurred in 1965, and that was Medicare, after a lot of battles and resistance and so on.
And Medicare was supposed to be the death of the economy, wasn't
it? That's right, and it was a boon
and it was.
To the economy and to practice of medicine and healthcare. So I think, Tom, you said something very important a few minutes ago, that if we do get something passed, it's likely to contain some very good things in it. And we should be grateful for that. And then if we feel that more needs to be done, our political system allows that. You know, we've got the whole future in front of us.
It doesn't have to be all or nothing,
does it?
And maybe gradual changes. I heard Senator Olympia Snowe talking this morning on the news before we got together. And she was saying that for some of these things, it's just a place to get started. Mm-hmm. That we can adjust over time. And she doesn't understand why people are trying to make wholesale changes all at once. Even then, whatever changes we make now, I believe it's 2013 before they're supposed to be implemented. Is that true, Dr. Dennison?
Yes, it is.
It is. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about the ethics and some of the things that you see that are good in what's being proposed. What do you see that is good beyond money questions for patients? Either one of you.
Well, I think there will be expanded coverage. I mean, that is about as beneficent as you can get.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that will help people. That will, we hope, reduce morbidity and mortality of disease, make it easier for people to seek medical care. And there's another thing, not just easier, but many people who don't have health insurance feel reluctant to access the medical care system.
Yes, they do.
And if
they do,
if they're covered, then they'll be less reluctant.
And they're fearful of what it's going to cost. The mm-hmm. reluctance, I think, comes from, I can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, this will help all of that. What are some of the issues that we aren't hearing much about or that are being kind of swept under the rug?
Well, one of them is illegal immigrants or illegal aliens.
Oh, everybody gets up in arms. They don't want illegal. Yes, that's
here
right.
In Syracuse, that was an issue in the newspaper for a month or two ago. And it's a very complex issue. On one hand, so-called illegal immigrants do come to this country, and most of them work. Not all of them, but many of them do, and they contribute to the economy. It's interesting that one source I consulted a few weeks ago indicated that 38% of the illegal immigrants actually are covered by health insurance. Yeah, of course, 62% are not.
Yeah.
And so there's that part of it. They contribute. And also, illegal immigrants as a group tend to be younger and therefore healthier and therefore seek less medical care. On the other hand, they would be an economic burden. Some estimates that I've read indicate that this would add – already we estimate spending about $4 to $5 billion on – and this might add another $20 to $30 billion.
Wow. You know what? That's a huge topic all by itself. Mm-hmm. We have run out of time, but Dr. Dennison, I thank you so much for coming by this morning. And Dr. Eastwood, we're going to pick up. We're not sure whether we'll do this in November or December or in January, but there is so much more to healthcare reform, and we've got so many more topics to cover. Maybe both of you gentlemen could join us again.
Look forward to it.
Thank you so much. And this is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air. We'll be back after a break. Mm-hmm.